So what happens is you paint yourself into a corner where it isn't the free decision that it would have been, because you have somebody in the room there with the syringe or there with the pills saying, well, are you going to do it or not? So a doctor is a reassurance, but a doctor is also pressure. And one is not better than the other. They're just bad in different ways.
This is the ODoc podcast with Dr. Gillian Wright. Our duty of care is a group of healthcare professionals who oppose assisted suicide and euthanasia. You can find out more at ourdutyofcare.org.uk. Now, here's Gillian with this week's guest.
Professor Jones is a professor of bioethics based at St Mary's in Twickenham, but also a research fellow in Blackfriars in Oxford, and also a clinical professor at the Catholic University in Sydney. Perhaps you could just outline the main types of conscientious objection.
Yeah, so conscientious objection, broadly speaking, there's two different divisions. One would be conscientious objection for an individual, or also conscientious objection for institutions, for organisations. Are organisations allowed to not participate? And this is particularly for hospices, but also in some countries, Catholic hospitals and so on. And at the level of individual, there is a subtle difference between a conscience clause and a no detriment clause. No detriment clause is that you wouldn't suffer any detriment if you decided to do it. Because typically, no detriment clauses work both ways, that you won't have any detriment if you decide not to participate, but you won't have any detriment if you do participate. And the problem with that is there's a tension between no detriment or participation and the ability of institutions to opt out. Because an institution can't opt out if the individuals within it can opt in without any detriment.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Because what it means is that you have someone who deliberately gets themselves into a hospice in order to start offering it in the hospice, and the hospice can't do anything about it. Even if the hospice has officially a policy about this, they can't do anything which would be detrimental to the ongoing employment of this person within the hospice. And given that both in the Scottish law and in the English law, it is possible for doctors proactively to raise this as a possibility, You could have people who are actively seeking to push this, to recruit for this.
I remember listening to the committee stage of the bill in November, and there was a very reasonable amendment which was raised, particularly supporting Salvation Army hostels. And so they had raised concerns that they, as on principle, wouldn't want to have assisted dying in their premises, you know, for people who were homeless, and for that was where their home was considered. And that was declined. The health committee said no, an organisation like the Salvation Army would have to assent to the provision of assisted suicide on their premises. And so there was a specific amendment asking for institutional opt-out, and Liam MacArthur said no at that stage, and the committee agreed with him.
So just to go back to the international comparisons, yeah. The United States, which has a no detriment model, one sort of conscience model, all the states in the United States give provision for institutions to opt out, and the no detriment provision has an exception for if you have a contract with an organization which doesn't do this, then they're allowed to say, we don't do this. Mm-hmm. So they're allowed to impose that contract on you, but only for what happens in the premises or when you're working for them, not outside of that.
Sure.
But what's happened in other countries, what's happened in Australia, is that they've gone from some respect for institutions to less and less respect, more and more requirements on institutions to cooperate. Mm. And then Australian Capital Territory, which is the most recent and the most extreme of the legislation, makes it a criminal offence not to facilitate. So if you're an administrator within an organisation, the Salvation Army, it's not only that you're required to do it, but if you don't do it, you're guilty of a criminal offence for which you might go to prison, which is sort of extraordinary.
But the real concern is that actually conscience is going to be taken out of the bill before the final vote. So maybe, David, if you're able to explain. Yeah.
Yes. The proposal, as I understand it from the Scottish minister, is simply to take it out of the bill, to vote for the bill without any reference to any conscientious objection at all, and hope that powers that be in Westminster will add it in later for the Scots, but essentially giving them a blank check, because rather than negotiate it before they vote, vote with that simply missing from the bill. As I understand it, that's what's being proposed. And that's deeply unsatisfactory.
That's my understanding as well. Yeah. So, yeah, just to explain for others who might not know. So health is devolved to Holyrood. So, you know, the NHS in Scotland is devolved, as it is in Wales. But medical regulation is not. So medical regulation is reserved to Westminster. And so it depends, as are other things, such as, you know, prescription of medications and regulation of medicines, things like that. Employment rights, for example, are still reserved to Westminster. So there's quite a lot of things which there's discussion about whether this bill is actually within the competency, within the sphere of influence of the Scottish Parliament. And what is the understanding of the letters that we've had at the moment, or the public statements that we've had from the Scottish Health team, have been that some matters, particularly the regulation of drugs, will be allowed to be part of the bill because of a particular section, but conscience won't be. And that will, like David says, be reserved to Westminster until the bill goes through, and then Westminster would add in a conscience clause. So I think it would be reasonable to expect that a conscience clause would be added, and that will be the plan. The question is, we don't know what. And I think what's really interesting hearing David explain is that there's a whole range of what conscience clauses might be like. There's a strong conscience clause at one end and a relatively weak at the other end, and also that the way that they have changed over time. And so I think the concern is that, you know, this bill would go to its final vote in Holyrood, and we don't have appeal to the House of Lords, and so it would go to its final vote in Holyrood, and then the conscience provisions would just be added on at a later stage. So it's really concerning democratically, actually, but also particularly for doctors and what might be given to us. It's so interesting, David. Thank you so much for explaining it to us. I imagine there will be more questions, actually. Or Victoria, would you like to make any comments about comparisons with Wales?
I can do, if that would be helpful. Good evening, everyone. Yeah, the fact that it's not entirely clear what's reserved to Westminster and what's devolved to the devolved nations is very similar in Wales. I think it needs to be clear that in Westminster, the sponsors are wanting to ensure that everybody offers this everywhere. So it's very clear in the Westminster bill that institutions would not be able to opt out. And at the moment, it seems that individuals would be able to opt out of providing the medication to a patient and of doing the assessments. But if you aren't willing to undertake an assessment of a patient, you would have an obligation to make an effective referral to somebody who would assess the patient. And many of us would find that really, really difficult.
The problem with the bill in Westminster, the Leadbeater bill, is that it's deeply ambiguous in relation to how it will be implemented, because there are 42 different clauses which say, well, it will be up to the Secretary of State to say how it's going to be implemented. So it's quite possible for a future Secretary of State to say it will only happen in the NHS and it won't happen in private institutions. It's quite possible for a future Secretary of State, therefore, to allow those institutions which are not participating, which are not part of the NHS, not to participate, as it were, to carve out various kinds of exceptions. We don't know what will be required of institutions because we don't know what the regulations will be. So as there is ambiguity in Wales and in Scotland because of the reserved powers, so the problem is, and this is, I think, more of a problem for Wales, Wales is being asked to give legislative consent to a bill where it's not clear what will be in the bill. It's not clear how the bill will be implemented because there's so much which is for future regulation. So the asking for consent in Wales is also for something where we have very little sense of implementation, much less so in Westminster than in Scotland. Scotland, was better up until we just had this new kind of ambiguity about reserve powers.
Yeah. There have been some concern for a long time whether even Holyrood, it's within the competence of Holyrood to legislate for any of this with respect to doctors, because I think I would argue that if medical regulation is reserved to Westminster, then none of the assessments, you know, all of that is medical. So it shouldn't just be conscience that's taken out of the bill. So I don't understand how you can positively regulate for doctors by Holyrood, but you can't negatively, if that makes sense. So I think it's quite complicated and needs a lot of sorting out. But Juliet's got a really interesting question about duty to inform. Do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, sure. No, it was just, I guess it's linked with what's going to be omitted from the Scottish bill as well. I think there are a lot of medical professionals that don't quite appreciate the implications of the duty to inform, a lot of doctors who feel that they wouldn't need to mention it. So I guess particularly in palliative care, you know, patients expressing, oh gosh, I wish it was all over, this is terrible, this is awful, you know, that's a very common thing to hear, particularly when the patients are first admitted, mm-hmm. or when you first see somebody in the community. It's a really common expression of suffering and distress that we would all hear. So to have to respond to that with an offer of assisted suicide, that's something that many clinicians think, oh gosh, I would never be in that situation, I would never have to do that. So whatever mention is made of that in the Scottish Bill, if that's going to be removed, we're very clear that Kim Leadbeater is absolutely adamant that all doctors should be offering this at every opportunity. I'd just be glad to hear Professor Jones's comments on how we might make MSPs in Scotland aware of the terrible implications of having to offer this as a response to the initial expression of a patient's suffering, which we often hear in hospitals in every care setting, when patients are you know, faced with terminal diagnosis, etc. And obviously the Montgomery ruling in Scotland, you know, makes it, if this is a medical treatment, then we actually have to offer it. It, you know, has become relevant for a patient, we have to offer it.
So both the Scottish and the English bills allow doctors to raise it proactively, but do not require it. So that they both say you don't have to raise it. This is in tension with Montgomery, obviously, if you think it's a medical treatment. But if you don't think it's a medical treatment or not a typical medical treatment for the purpose of Montgomery, then you wouldn't have to raise it. This is the view of the British Medical Association. The British Medical Association said it's not a medical treatment for the purpose of law. It would be helpful if they do come into force, then I think it would be helpful for them to say explicitly that this is not a medical treatment for the purpose of law and regulation. Because otherwise what happens is that the norms of law and regulation are that you will then be pushed to give it. I mean, and the fact that it's not a medical treatment, it becomes even more obvious in relation to consent. Because if ending somebody's life deliberately by giving lethal medication was a medical intervention for the alleviation of suffering, then it ought to be given for people who can't consent. There is no form of pain relief which is only given to people who can consent. If this is a form of pain relief, which is standard medical treatment, then it could be given for people who can't consent, but who are in pain when you think that this is the most effective way to treat their pain. I don't think that those who are in favour of the bill wish to have that, but that's just an illustration that this is not typical medical treatment. But it would still be better if the bill said that more explicitly than it does. The Medical Defence Union has another interesting twist on this in relation to that you can bring it up, but you don't have to bring it up. They interestingly would prefer it if it were a medical treatment that you had to bring up, because they say if it's not a medical treatment, if there's no obligation to bring it up, then the question is, why did you? So if you bring it up and it's very distressing to the patient and the patient complains, then the usual defense of the doctor will be, I brought this up because this is good medical practice to bring up that this is an option. But if you can't rely on good medical practice because you have no obligation to bring it up, why are you bringing it up if you don't have any obligation to do so? only because you would actually quite, you know, you think that in their case, they will be better off dead. I mean, it puts the doctor in a position of vulnerability, according to the defense union. They're more defensive in their kind of stance. So they prefer everything which is not required is prohibited. And you have to have some discretion, but they do reasonably put this case that there is a problem at the moment, both in Scotland and in England, with this notion that doctors could be proactively suggesting it, but at the same time saying that nobody has any duty in any circumstance to raise it with the patient. And I think that the tendency will be to go in a Canadian direction, because that is always the tendency. And in Canada, you do have an obligation to raise it.
Yeah. I think there's a lot there. I don't know whether, Juliette, you want to come back in.
Right. Yeah. No, I think I was really interested hearing from our Canadian colleague about that, even in the States where there wasn't a duty informed, that there was a fear from the medical professionals that they would be criticized for not reading it. And I guess that, you know, that the culture shift that feels almost inevitable in a situation like this.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think one of the really difficult things that you brought up was just about lack of capacity. And I think that's really important, because one of the aspects of using the Mental Capacity Act or the Adult with Incapacity Act in Scotland is that one of the reasons we have legislation is so that we can act in people's best interests to give them medical treatments. And, you know, if we are using it for those who have capacity, then why should we not use it for those who don't have capacity? And it seems extraordinary. And I absolutely have sure that that's not the intention of the drafters of the bill. But if you use the Adults with Incapacity Act or the Mental Capacity Act, you know, you have to use all of it. You can't pick and choose. And so it will be very difficult for them to justify in times to come why it's not for someone who is suffering and terminally ill. So it's very, very dangerous grounds, I think. But not something particularly we want to talk about, because it is so awful. I think, Victoria, did you want to come back in?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I've already started to do advanced care planning, whereby patients who I know are very opposed to assisted dying, I write in their advanced care plan or future care plan, there are no circumstances under which I would wish the possibility of assisted dying to be raised with me. And then that initial conversation when the patient's not so ill gets everybody else off the hook. So that's just something to think about. But also, even if we have a duty to raise it according to Montgomery, those of us who maybe are skilled and have the luxury of time for our what matters to me conversations, if a patient's telling you clearly that what matters to them is length of life and quality of life, but particularly length of life, and you can document that, then that would get you out of offering any option that might shorten life. And it's a very faint hope, and it's a very thin straw that I'm clutching at, but that would, for some patients, get you out of having to do it.
So in the Canadian guidelines, I mean, this isn't hard law by any means. The guidelines have been produced by clinicians, and typically they've been produced by high volume practitioners. That is to say, the people who are pushing at the edges of what's legal. But even in those guidelines, they say that you have a duty to offer it if it is compatible with the therapeutic aims and values of the patient or something like that. So there is a sense of that if you can document, I hope that we don't get into this situation, but if we did get into this situation, then it would become more important for people to document their wishes and feelings in a context where this is something which could be proactively offered, and proactively offered more than once, and, you know, by different clinicians and by people when they were at a low ebb. So I think that it's not only for people who lack capacity, it's also for people who have capacity, but they want to have some control over the kinds of conversations that people have when they are, and there's been a lot of discussion about this, both north and south of the border, the power dynamic of the doctor and the patient, and the situation where someone might think of requesting that their life be ended, is one of extreme vulnerability. And that's why capacity on its own, whether it's the Scottish Act or the English Act, isn't sufficient, because that's a minimal standard of that somebody could consent to something if it were in their best interest. It's not, I think, enough to guard against suicidal ideation. That's why you have the Mental Health Act 1983, which may need to be looked at in terms of human rights. But I think it shows that there's another spectrum of vulnerability to do with valuing your life and to do with framing decisions about intentionally ending your life, which are not just about capacity in the minimal sense. And I don't think either act gives sufficient weight to those kind of considerations at the moment.
Right. Is there any other country where the doctor's required to stay with the patient until they die? Or is that going to be unique to Scotland?
No, it's unique and bizarre. I think they're thinking of changing it in Australia. So I think they're thinking of changing it where the doctor comes and then you do it or you don't do it and the doctor takes the stuff away. This is because of a case in Queensland where they offer you a choice. So a woman with cancer was given a self-administration, a poison to keep herself. And then she decided she didn't want to do it herself. She wanted to have the doctor do it, which is the norm. It's usually the doctor does it when you have a choice. But she didn't give the poison back. And then the husband, in his grief, took it and died. And that was something that they want to try to figure out. But to go back to my Anna Karenina point, in Anna Karenina, it says every happy family is happy in the same way, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. There isn't a perfect solution to this, because if you don't have a doctor present, you've no idea what their frame of mind is when they take it. You've no idea about complications when they take it. You've no idea how long people take to die. And that's the case of most in Oregon. We don't have proper data because a medical professional was there when they died. But on the other hand, in 30% of cases, they have the poison, they keep it in the cupboard, they never take it. Whereas if a doctor comes and he's waiting, then and you've invited him or her and won't go until either you take it or you decide not to, so what happens then? So what happens in Canada? In Canada, you have a final consent. You have to consent to it before it's actually done. How many people don't consent in that circumstance? Less than 1%. Because it would just be embarrassing to send them away. So what happens is you paint yourself into a corner where it isn't the free decision that it would have been, because you have somebody in the room there with the syringe or there with the pills saying, well, are you going to do it or not? And that puts pressure on, which you don't have if you just say, well, you take it, and if you want to, then do so. So a doctor is a reassurance, but a doctor is also pressure. And one is not better than the other. They're just bad in different ways.
So many layers of difficulty and complications with this, aren't there? It's really grim. I think the more people think about this, you know, just even tonight, there have been things that have been raised that are concerning, that are different. It's so good to have had you with us. David, I really appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much. Good night.
You've been listening to the ODoc podcast. To find out more or to join the campaign, visit ourdutyofcare.org.uk. Thanks for listening.